Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Partners for Progressive Israel Conversations with Israel and Palestine program. Today we'll be speaking with Gershon Baskin about some of the changes that have taken place in Gaza since Operation Protective Edge and the 2005 disengagement. So first, a few technical matters. All callers will be muted while Gershon is speaking. When we open the call to questions, you will be able to unmute yourself, and I'll provide instructions later on. So now a bit of background about our speaker. Dr. Gershon Baskin was the Israeli co-director and founder of the Israel-Palestine Center for Research and Information, a joint Israeli-Palestinian public policy think tank. He served as an advisor on the Israeli-Palestinian peace process to a secret team of intelligence officers established by Yitzhak Rabin and was a member of the Jerusalem Experts Committee established by the Israeli Prime Minister's office during the final status negotiations in 2000 to 2001. He is on the board of numerous organizations, including One Voice and the Alliance for Middle East Peace, and has a regular column in the Jerusalem Post. Perhaps his most well-known achievement is leading the secret back-channel negotiations between Israel and Hamas that secured the release of the Israeli abducted soldier, Gilad Shalit. Dr. Baskin speaks Hebrew, English, and Arabic, and since 2012 has been working to develop renewable energy projects around the Middle East. So please, Gershon, go ahead.
Good afternoon, everyone over there. Good evening from Jerusalem. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I hope we can have an interesting discussion. The subject of Gaza and relations with Hamas have been in the news quite frequently lately, primarily because of talks that were started at the initiative of former Quartet head Tony Blair, who was reportedly meeting on a regular basis with Khaled Mashal, the head of the Hamas Politburo in Qatar, and other members of the Hamas leadership. Reports were released in Turkish newspapers and in other papers around the Middle East that he was advancing discussions on a long-term ceasefire between Israel and Hamas that would end the economic siege on Gaza, that would provide for the possible opening up of some kind of seaport for Gaza that would be stationed in Cyprus or someplace else, all different kinds of conditions that were reported on. I was interviewed constantly over the past weeks on whether or not these reports were in fact real. What I was able to determine from talks with people both in Israel and in Hamas and in other parts of the Middle East is that it's true that Tony Blair was out there and Tony Blair was conducting these talks. People in Hamas told me that the talks were quite serious, but the question that they had, and in fact someone from Hamas asked me for my assessment on it, was whether or not Tony Blair was in fact acting on behalf of Benjamin Netanyahu and the government of Israel as well. My response to that was I doubt it very seriously. I could not see in any way, and I said this on Israeli radio and television as well, in any way that Netanyahu had given Tony Blair an okay to act on behalf of Israel in these talks. At the most, Tony Blair got a wink of the eye from Netanyahu and said, if you achieve anything, come back to me and we'll talk about it. But it would seem so counterintuitive to imagine that Netanyahu, with his own political ideology, would engage in any of these talks of any kind that would empower what is perceived to be one of Israel's greatest enemies. There is only one scenario under which I could imagine that the talks were real and that he was in fact acting in coordination and perhaps on behalf of Netanyahu, because if there were to be a deal at this point between Israel and Hamas, the victim, the primary loser of the deal would be Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority. In fact, it would put an end, I think, to any kind of future of, in the foreseeable future, of Palestinian moderate leadership, such as the PLO-led leadership of Mahmoud Abbas and other people within the PLO. It would empower the extremists who are still committed to Israel's destruction in Hamas and in other organizations that are affiliated with Hamas, like the Islamic Jihad. It would lead to, in my mind, the takeover of the West Bank by Hamas, either with elections or without elections. And it would send a very clear message to everyone in the Middle East that you don't get anything from Israel unless you use violence and force against Israel. So I think it would be a total mistake. It would go along with Netanyahu's ideology and practice of preventing the establishment of a Palestinian state in the West Bank. That's what would happen. There would be likely a Palestinian state in Gaza, which would be detrimental, I believe, to the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian people and anyone who supports a two-state solution, because once there is a Palestinian state, even if it's only in Gaza, it loses its importance on the international agenda. People will say there's already a Palestinian state. What do we have to talk about it anymore? The issue of Palestine has been resolved. And we all know that that's not true and that the occupation in the West Bank would continue along with more active settlement building and probably the next round of violence. Because it's not clear that Tony Blair was talking about a hutna, a ceasefire, a treaty that would also encompass the West Bank. Hamas were saying that they only have authority over Gaza, and they were talking about Gaza from their point of view. They wanted an end to the economic siege on Gaza, and they would be willing to engage in a long-term ceasefire. But anyone who knows about Hamas's ideology and people in Hamas, including its founder, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, who was the first person to talk about a hutna, a ceasefire with Israel, even a 10-year ceasefire, base it on in Sharia jurisprudence. Ahmed Yassin was once quoted as saying, if the Prophet Muhammad entered into a hutna, a 10-year truce, with the Quraysh tribe in Mecca and with the Jews in Mecca, then how could I be any less than the Prophet Muhammad, which gave justification for Hamas to be able to enter into a 10-year treaty? But the principle of the hutna that the Prophet Muhammad entered into with Quraysh at that time was that they were able to continue to build their forces and build their strength. And that's part of the ideology of Hamas as well, is that they're willing to have a ceasefire. To the best of my knowledge, they rejected any kind of proposal that was presented by Tony Blair that they would have to cease their tunnel building, they would have to shut down their rocket building enterprise, they could not build their military forces anymore. This was not part of any kind of deal that Hamas would agree to. Hamas was clearly interested in doing this now because Hamas is very weak. Hamas is bankrupt financially. They've lost the income that they used to get through the tunnels that have been shut down by Abdel Fattah Sisi, the president of Egypt. Along the Sinai border, the smuggling enterprises that went into Gaza are almost finished. There's still a few working tunnels that the Egyptians allowed to leave open, both for transporting fuel into Gaza and other emergency needs, but basically 1,000 tunnels were shut down and Hamas lost millions and millions of dollars of income that they used to run their government and their fighting forces. In the aftermath of Protective Edge, Hamas continued to build its forces, which it's doing now, in the same way that they did after, Oferet Yitzhuka and Kastled. The technique that Hamas's fighting force, Ezzedine Qassam, uses is to go around to the bereaved families in Gaza, those who lost people in the war with Israel, and recruit the next generation of fighters, and giving them both the chance for revenge against Israel, those who killed their fathers, their brothers, their uncles, and also to give them the opportunity to become martyrs for Palestine, guarantee them heaven and all the prizes that are brought with that. As well, as everyone knows, that when there is a shaheed, when there is a martyr from a Palestinian family, particularly from Hamas, that their families are well looked after financially by the Hamas charities that provide income on a regular basis for those families. So that's the situation in Gaza. It's a very bad situation. There's basically no hope for 90% of the people who live in Gaza. There has been reported in the Western media over the last week, new hotels that have been opened and new shopping malls, and we get this beautiful picture of Gaza on the beach, but that's for a very small part of the population that gets to enjoy it. More than 60% unemployment in Gaza. More than 80% of the people living in Gaza are living under the poverty line. It's really a tragic situation. They can't move anywhere. The borders are closed. Very few people can get out through Israel to Jordan, to the rest of the Arab world. The Egyptians have basically shut down the Rafah crossing into Egypt and allow very few people to cross. So people are stuck there. The economy is shut down. Basically, when people talk about ending the siege, most people have talked about the goods that enter Gaza. That was really never the main problem of the siege. It was much more that the economy of Gaza was shut down because goods couldn't get out of Gaza. The whole manufacturing sector of Gaza, some 80 to 90% of the small factories that used to exist there are shut down because the economy of Gaza is too poor to buy the goods that they produce and too small of a market to sell them. They were dependent on selling goods to the West Bank and to the rest of the region, including to Israel, which doesn't happen anymore. So ending the siege has to be a two-way street where goods and people are allowed in and out of Gaza. And by the way, Israel could do that and should do that without a truce or a ceasefire with Hamas. It is in the interest of Israel to create a more normal political and economic life for people in Gaza. No one deserves to suffer the way that the people in Gaza are suffering, and Israel could have a great deal of ability to impact change there. Israel has the ability to engage with the private sector leadership in Gaza, who still exist, who are still the moderate leadership of Gaza. They should be engaging with these people, and they should be searching for ways to go around Hamas, not through Hamas. And, of course, the bottom line, in my mind, for the future of Gaza, and would be dependent upon Israel accepting the Arab Peace Initiative from 2002 as the basis for negotiations with the Palestinians. And if Israel were to do that, accepting the Arab Peace Initiative, Israel would be able to, together with the Palestinian Authority, of the PLO, bring the issue of Gaza to the table of the Arab League to be dealt with in a wider regional framework. I go back to the agreement that was made by the Arab League in Taif to end the civil war in Lebanon, when decisions were made to send a multinational Arab-led force into Lebanon at that time to end the civil war. That's the same kind of solution that could eventually be devised for Gaza if it was part of a larger framework of Israeli-Palestinian negotiations based on the Arab Peace Initiative, involving, of course, Egypt and Jordan and the Saudis and the Emirates and the Kuwaitis and the Omanis and the Qataris, even Morocco and Tunisia. Within the wider framework of the moderate Sunni states engaged in the Arab League, with a wider effort of creating a regional forum for stability and security that involves Gaza and eventually would lead to the freedom of the Palestinians in their own Palestinian state, which would, as the Palestinians have always agreed, be a demilitarized state, and as such, Gaza, as being part of that future state, would also have to be demilitarized. So the decommissioning of weapons and rockets there would be part of a larger framework. This is not something that would happen overnight. It would obviously take a longer period of time, but it would be in the interest of the Palestinian people themselves to get rid of a more extreme leadership, to forfeit their arms in favor of having freedom and liberation in the framework of a Palestinian state where Gaza would still be part of it. And this is not just a pipe dream. This is not something which is impossible to imagine. It is perhaps impossible to imagine with the current leadership of the government of Israel, but I'll conclude these opening remarks with a statement that will appear in my Jerusalem Post article tomorrow morning, that the distance between where we are and peace and security is leadership. That's what we're missing, and that's what's required to bring us to where we need to be. It's not so far away if we can imagine that there could be a different leadership, perhaps also on the Palestinian side, but most definitely on the Israeli side. So I'll end with that, and we can open it up for discussion.
Okay, great. So so now, just as a reminder, if you have a question for Gershon, you'll need to press star 6 to unmute your call. We ask that you remember to remute your call after you've asked your question by pressing star 6 again, and this will help us tremendously to cut down on background noise. Let's start with some questions.
Gershon, it's Lenny Grav calling. Hi, thanks for doing this. Gershon, obviously Mahmoud Abbas is not just sitting there and hearing all the talk about Blair and what's going on. He has to have some idea of what's going to happen in the future. I know that there's talk of reconstituting the Palestinian National Council. But what do you think that there may be something going on between the PLO and Hamas that we don't know about?
No, I think that the distance between Hamas and the PLO is greater now than it's ever been before. The reconciliation process has completely broken down. For the last couple of months, the rumors of talks between Israel and Hamas were primarily coming from the circles of Mahmoud Abbas and the PLO and Fatah, aiming at putting pressure on Hamas as threatening to dissolve the Palestinian issue by creating a separate Palestinian state in Gaza. Hamas and Fatah are not talking at all, and it doesn't seem as if there's any chance in the foreseeable future for that kind of reconciliation between them. So I think that relations are really, really bad. The separation between Gaza and the West Bank is worse than ever. I met a couple of weeks ago with one of the most senior Palestinian officials from their security forces. I talked to him about the problem of the two bodies of Israeli soldiers and the two Israeli civilians that are being held by Hamas in Gaza, and whether or not the PLO, Mahmoud Abbas and his people, perhaps the security people, could have any influence on Hamas in those talks that are going on between Israel and the parties to try and bring them back. And the answer that I got was absolutely not. There was a zero chance of influence from the PLO, from Fatah, from Abbas to Hamas these days, and there's no communication at all.
Thanks, Kirsten.
This is Dan Fleshler. Hi. The Iran deal, as you know, is being objected to by people who say that Iran is going to get money to fund its proxies, and they always sort of reflexively say, you know, Hezbollah and Hamas. My impression, and from what I've read, is that ties between Hamas and Iran has suffered greatly, that there are some attempts to make some linkages between them now and renew it. But could you comment on that part of the equation?
The political and economic ties between Hamas and Iran broke down in 2012 when Tehran was making demands on Hamas to support Bashar al-Assad in Syria. By that time, Hamas had already moved out of Damascus, mainly because they were being attacked by Syrian forces and they refused to support Assad and his regime while they were attacking Sunnis and Palestinians in particular. At that time, Hamas had moved to Egypt. But before they made the move to Egypt, when Egypt was being run by the Muslim Brotherhood, before they moved to Egypt, Tehran encouraged Khalid Mashal and his people to move the Politburo leadership of Hamas to Tehran. And that was made conditional, of course, on Hamas supporting Assad, who was their host for so many years. And the Hamas leadership decided that they could not do that. They could not support Assad. And at that point, the relations with Tehran were basically cut off, and Tehran stopped providing funding and military support for Hamas. Tehran has been providing funding and military support for Islamic Jihad in Gaza, and Islamic Jihad could be a beneficiary of funds that would be loosened up once Iran, the sanctions on Iran are lifted. And this is, of course, worrisome. I think it's worrisome for Israel, and it's also has Hamas quite worried about it as well. Hamas doesn't want any kind of competition in terms of control, and in particular military control of Gaza, and an empowered Islamic Jihad with a lot of extra money and perhaps weapons could be a threat to Hamas, not directly in terms of the control of Gaza, but it could be a great nuisance and a factor that would create greater instability in Gaza.
Thanks.
Hi, Gershon?
Yes.
Hi, this is Dina Charnin. How are you?
Hi, Dina.
Hi, Mashal Khan. Hi. I have a question for you. Since you ended your column or emphasized in your coming column and your talk now, the leadership and the failure of leadership and what you'd like to see leadership do, mm-hmm. and the fact that people seem to constantly project their hopes onto Bibi, hoping that he's going to do something in that direction, I was just wondering what your analysis of others in the government and others that you've come in contact with who might be somehow influential in the attitude or angle that you emphasize and that many of us here probably agree with.
Right. Well, I'm constantly in the search of people who are willing to demonstrate some kind of leadership. I was engaged with a senior member of the Likud in a series of discussions over the last weeks. Someone who is very close to Netanyahu and has his ear, and yet is thought to be a more independent actor. And I received an offer from a senior official on the Palestinian side who's very close to Abbas, with a proposal that they engage in not a secret back channel of negotiations. The Palestinian leader called it an investigation, a kind of checking the water, determining what are the gaps and where are possible areas of agreement. And I passed this message on to this senior Likud person, hoping that they would agree and I could help to facilitate this discussion that would take place. And the answer that I got back after a few weeks of waiting for the answer was that the boss said no. And the boss, of course, is Netanyahu. I don't think that there's any chance of seeing any kind of alternative leadership within the Likud right now at this time when Netanyahu has the iron fist control of the party, of the government. He's in a precarious situation because with a majority of one in the Knesset, everyone can make demands, and Netanyahu is giving in to demands of people in order to keep the stability of the government. But it doesn't seem to me that anyone in the right wing of Israel is willing to step out on a limb on the Palestinian issue. It's perceived by them and in the public of being an anti-vote-getter. You don't gain support in Israel today by taking strong positions on the Palestinian issue, so I don't see it coming from there. Question is whether or not the leader of our opposition in the Israeli Knesset, Mr. Herzog, has the ability to demonstrate any kind of leadership. He has been engaging in a kind of ridiculous polemic debate with Gideon Levy on the pages of Haaretz, which I don't really understand the background of and why Herzog is doing that. Herzog could and should, as the leader of the opposition, present an alternative to the people of Israel and demonstrate what Israelis need to hear more than anything else, and that's that we have Palestinian partners, because the lack of belief in Israel and in Palestine in the possibility of peace is primarily because most Israelis and most Palestinians today believe that there's no partner on the other side. And I think that the job of the opposition in Israel, or any responsible politician or someone who sees himself as a leader, is to rebuild the partnerships across the conflict lines. We have to show people that peace is possible. We know how to do it. Everyone knows what an agreement looks like. We know that a majority of people on both sides of the conflict would even support it if they believed that it was possible. And we need to demonstrate that it's possible by rebuilding this leadership, this partnership, and we need leaders to do it. And I haven't yet seen the leaders, not on the right and not on the left, unfortunately, who are stepping up to the plate and going for it.
Gershon, this is Frank Bamberger in Brooklyn. Talking about the Palestinian leadership, some people think that it might be an idea for if the Palestinians had a new election and elected Mahmoud Myron Barghouti as their president, do you see that as a possible scenario, and how would one go about promoting it?
Well, there's no doubt that the Palestinians need to go to elections again. Mahmoud Abbas was elected 11 years ago. For a four-year term, the Palestinian parliament, which has not functioned since 2007, was elected 10 years ago, and they have no parliament, they have no legislative framework, and the government of Palestine is not seen as legitimate by most Palestinians. By the way, Israel has a large part of the responsibility in the delegitimation of Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian leadership. He didn't achieve that only on his own. He had a lot of help from Israel by not delivering what he promised to deliver to the public when he got elected with a large majority, which was ending the occupation and bringing about a Palestinian state. Palestinians need to have elections. The big dilemma for them is, do they have elections only in the West Bank? Can they have elections that would take place in Gaza as well? What about the other institutions? You have to remember that Mahmoud Abbas is not only the president of the Palestinian Authority or the Palestinian state, the State of Palestine as it's now called, by Palestinians. He's also the head of Fatah, and he's also the chairman of the executive committee of the PLO, which is the body which created the Palestinian Authority. It is now from the executive committee of the PLO that he announced his resignation, and there will be new elections for an executive committee of the PLO. This is the senior ruling body of the Palestinian people, because the Palestinian Authority represents Palestinians only in Palestine. The PLO represents Palestinians all over the world. So it is the more senior body. It's known that Abbas announced his resignation together with 10 other members of the executive committee in order to remove some of the troublemakers, as he relates to them, within the executive committee. He wants to bring people closer to him that he has more control over, people that are more aligned with his own politics and his own ambitions. National elections need to be held for the president and for the parliament of the state of Palestine. Marwan Barghouti consistently comes out number one in all the surveys as the person who beats every other candidate. Marwan Barghouti is, of course, in Israeli prison, serving 5 life sentences plus 60 years for his responsibility in leading the Second Intifada and bringing about the death of at least 5 Israelis that he was charged with. Marwan refused to recognize the legitimacy of the Israeli court. He provided no defense in his trial. He said that the trial was illegal. He was an elected official. He was the Secretary General of the Fatah movement and a member of the Palestinian parliament when he was arrested by Israel during the Second Intifada. So this is a kind of fudge course. He was also not convicted of actually killing anyone himself. In other words, no one presented evidence in the court that Marwan Barghouti had shot someone, had blown someone up, had killed someone. He was convicted with the responsibility for the death of Israelis, but he never actually did it himself. This might be a kind of a fudge clause that would enable his release. Certainly, one way for Marwan to be released in the future is if he were, in fact, elected president of Palestine. There would be an enormous amount of pressure on Israel from the international community to release from prison the person who was elected to be president of the state of Palestine. A lot of people in the Israeli peace camp know Marwan quite well. I spent more than 200 hours with him personally in dialogue and discussions and meetings that he organized together with us and participated in. He is someone who believes in peace and believes in the two-state solution. He would be a very tough negotiator. He's a man of principle. He's a man of charisma. I don't think that he really is a manager or a person who would know how to run a state, but the president of Palestine could bring in a qualified prime minister who could run the affairs of the state on a day-to-day basis and provide the kind of leadership that the Palestinians would want to lead them out of occupation and hopefully toward peace. So I think it is possible. I understand. I see Marwan's lawyer from time to time. In fact, most recently, asked to get a copy of my book about the negotiations for Gilad Shalit, so I'm sending him a book to prison. I think it would be very interesting if that would happen. He is, and certainly if he does run, he looks like he would win, and then we'll have to deal with that reality when it happens.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
David Abraham, Miami. Given what you report about the Blair discussions and how they would both underscore the principle that the Israelis, in fact, understand only force and the deleterious effect it would have on Abbas and company, how should the peace camp respond to what sounds like some kind of movement towards something peaceful? It's a trap we see, but how do we respond?
Well, I responded by trying to point out the negative aspects of the deal and why we shouldn't support it. And what we should continue to support is negotiations between Israel and the PLO and the Arab League through the Arab Peace Initiative. Any deal that's reached with the PLO and certainly the wider deal with the Arab League states would have to be honored by Hamas. Hamas can oppose a deal just done between Israel and Fatah. Hamas can't oppose a deal that involves the wider Arab circle of the Sunni states. In fact, we saw it back in years ago. I think back in 2007, there was a thing called the Prisoner's Document. And in the Prisoner's Document, it was a kind of agreement of all the Palestinian forces to engage in reconciliation between Fatah and Hamas. And in the Prisoner's Document, by the way, Marwan Barghouti was one of the people who authored the Prisoner's Document, there was in the preamble, a recognition of the legitimacy of the Arab Peace Initiative. And here you had Hamas agree to it because they had no choice. There was a decision of the Arab League that they would recognize Israel and enter into peaceful relations with Israel if Israel ended its occupation and created the Palestinian state, et cetera, et cetera. And at that point, because it was the Arab Peace Initiative of the Arab League, Hamas could not say no to it. Well, I think it would be very bad for us in the peace camp to think that by having a deal between Israel and Hamas, we're going to end up with a peaceful Gaza. We're going to end up not with a peaceful Gaza, in my mind, and not with a peaceful West Bank, and we'll empower the extremists, and it will be bad for Palestinians, and it will be bad for Israel.
Next question.
May I ask a question? Irena Levitan from Chicago. Thank you very much for doing this.
My pleasure.
Following your publications and your posts very much. My question is, I heard several times read several times from Palestinians sources, including peace activists, that what was proposed at Camp David to Arafat was absolutely impossible for Palestinians to accept. Sorry for going back that far. Could you comment?
Okay.
What was it that was impossible to accept? Was it the refugee problem? And if it was, how it can be resolved possibly peacefully?
Okay, I got the question. At Camp David, the so-called generous offer of Barak, it was called a generous offer because it was more generous than anything that had ever been on the table beforehand. But the bottom line on the offer of Barak at Camp David, and it was made as a take-it-or-leave-it offer, was that Israel was willing to withdraw from 89% of the West Bank. Israel demanded that there be two east-west corridors cutting the West Bank into three cantons where those corridors, those east-west roads, would be under full Israeli control. And in addition to that, Israel demanded a full security perimeter around the entire borders of the Palestinian state, both in the Jordan Valley and around the Green Line on the side of Israel. Palestinians called that a sovereign cage. In Camp David, there was no discussion about Palestinian sovereignty over the Palestinian neighborhoods of East Jerusalem or the Old City. In Camp David, the Israelis offered the Palestinians a capital in Abu Dis, which is outside the municipal boundaries of Jerusalem. At Camp David, in the 14 days of Camp David, there were a total of 6 hours of discussions on the refugee issue. Camp David did not explode on the refugee issue. They didn't even really get into the discussion of refugees at Camp David. The point of explosion at Camp David when the summit ended was when Barak tried to get Arafat through Clinton to agree that Jews would be allowed to construct a place for Jewish prayer on the Temple Mount in exchange for giving Muslims control over the mosque on the Temple Mount. That was the point when Arafat told Clinton that the next time he sees him would be at his funeral because the Palestinians were negotiating on Jerusalem on behalf of more than a billion Muslims and not just on behalf of the Palestinians. So that was a non-starter. 6 months later, by the way, in Taba, in January of 2001, the Israeli offer went up to 96% of the West Bank. The security parameter was removed. There were no east-west corridor roads under Israeli control. And by Taba in 2001, the Israelis had accepted the Clinton parameters for Jerusalem, which would have given the Palestinians a capital inside of Jerusalem and sovereignty over all the Palestinian neighborhoods in Jerusalem, while the Israelis would have sovereignty over all the Israeli neighborhoods in Jerusalem, including those built beyond the Green Line in Jerusalem. In Taba, there was a proposal for dealing with the refugee problem through a recipe book of offers that Palestinian refugees would have a choice on, with the first choice, with great incentives, would be to the right of return to the state of Palestine. Then there would be staying in the host countries, mostly relevant regarding Jordan. And thirdly, a list of countries that would agree to absorb Palestinian refugees, of which Israel would be included on the list. Each country would determine how many refugees it was willing to accept, under what conditions. Every Palestinian refugee who had property claims would be able to make them to an international tribunal, and an international fund would be created. This was all part of the Clinton parameters that were brought into the Taba talks. The Taba talks ended prematurely, both because there was a terrorist attack inside of Israel, and Barak called the team home, but more directly because by that point we were 10 days away from elections. Barak was leading a minority government. He didn't have legitimacy for negotiations. He himself did not participate in those negotiations that were being run by Shlomo Ben Ami. And, of course, 10 days later, in February of 2001, Barak lost in a landslide victory to Ariel Sharon.
Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Yes, this was it. Very impressive explanation. Thank you.
Mark Bamberger again. I'm wondering what your take is on a international force in the Jordan Valley. It's an issue that, can you imagine, was recently raised in a American TV series called House of Cards?
Anyway, yeah. It was also back in the West Wing during the famous summit that President Bartlet held at Camp David with the Palestinians and Israelis. They dealt with it there. My position on the issue of security for the peace is that this is not something that can or should be subcontracted out to others. There's no reason why some kid from Iowa or Chicago or New York City should have to die or risk his life defending the peace between Israelis and Palestinians if Israelis and Palestinians don't do it together, don't relate to the security issues as the most fundamental pillar of any future Israeli-Palestinian peace, then there won't be peace. This is also what I respond to Israelis who say, we cannot depend on anyone but ourselves to defend ourselves, and I agree with that. The only way to have a long-term Israeli military presence anywhere in the Palestinian state is only within the framework of a joint security mechanism, which would be command and patrol jointly by Israelis and Palestinians in designated locations with designated tasks. Along the Jordan Valley, it could include the Jordanians on the other side of the border as well. But it has to be done something that's controlled by Israelis and Palestinians together, where the forces run within the Palestinian state. It has to be under a Palestinian commander so that the Palestinians are not subcontractors of the Israelis, as the security framework was developed in the Oslo process with the joint patrols, and even until today, the so-called security cooperation is really fundamentally the Palestinians serving Israeli security needs and much less their own. That needs to change conceptually within the framework of a peace agreement, and there are tasks that could be done on the Israeli side of the border in a joint force as well. I can imagine, for instance, where Ben-Gurion Airport becomes once again an airport where Palestinians fly out of, where there could be Palestinian military personnel, security personnel, doing the security checks on Palestinian passengers. Their commander would be an Israeli because it would be within Israeli sovereign area, but the force itself could be Palestinian, and here you have some kind of counterbalance. It could be joint forces at the border crossings, which need to be significantly improved and upgraded, and people have to be able to move freely, more or less freely across borders, because the situation that we have is ridiculous, and it's not a peace-building situation. I mean, millions and millions of people move across borders safely every day around the world, and they don't do it by being humiliated and having to stand in endless lines or stand for hours to get permits to move. All these things can be done by computer, online, and eventually we have to work toward getting to open borders between the two states with security functions being held in a different way. But I think this whole idea of NATO forces or American forces or other foreign forces here is a negative one, and it's not a peace-building mechanism.
Gershon?
It's Lily Ridlin.
Go ahead.
Can I go on?
Yeah.
Hi, Lily.
Hi, Gershon.
kol hakavod, you know, you are the most informed person still, and that you still go on where many of us, well, I'll speak for myself, have lost hope. I really
You shouldn't. We have your cousin who's the biggest surprise in Israel.
Yeah, but you know what he said the other day. But let us
It doesn't matter. He's demonstrated such amazing moral leadership in Israel that's been so absent from this country for so many years.
Yeah, that I agree. I agree. But I also think where there's a will, there's a way. However, I have a question, which is, I would like to know if you know what Malcho is.
Oh, Malcho, yes.
Because he has always been, certainly as far as I remember, the guy that is sent out secretly to do whatever has to be done. What is he doing these days?
Well, it's almost impossible to know. You know, I was at the American Ambassador's July 4th party, which this year was held on July 1st.
Yes, I read it. I read what you wrote. Okay.
and I met Mocho there, and I went up to talk to him. And, of course, I began my approach to him by saying, why don't you ever agree to talk to me? And he said, don't take it personally. I don't talk to anyone. And that's true. He doesn't talk to anyone. He reports directly to Netanyahu. He gets sent on missions by Netanyahu. 2 weeks ago, he was with four other military people on a mission to Cairo. No one knows what they talked about. It somehow got leaked to the newspaper that Mocho and four other Israeli security people were in Cairo and met with the head of the Egyptian intelligence there. I don't know if they also met with Sisi or other people, but no one knows. No one knows what he does. It's not public knowledge. People in the government don't know. People in the, to the best of my knowledge, within the security forces in Israel don't know what Mocho is up to and what he does. He reports to the boss, and he takes instructions to the boss, and he's not accountable to anyone else.
Okay, thanks.
We know, by the way, when the talks, the so-called Kerry talks of 9 months were being held, and Tzipi Livni was officially the head of those talks. The real head of the talks is Mocho. Mocho was running the show. Mocho prevented any serious discussions from taking place there on territorial compromises. It was reported, and probably people saw this, it was reported that at one point when the negotiations were actually taking place at the beginning, in the first 3 or 4 months of the nine-month period, Mocho had left the room to go to the bathroom, and while he was out of the room, Saar Barikat or someone else said, why don't we play a trick on Mocho and put a map on the table? So they did, and Mocho came back into the room and almost had a heart attack. Said, what's a map doing on the table? You're negotiating away Israel while I was in the bathroom? This was a joke, and you think about it, the whole thing is a joke, because how can you have territorial negotiations without talking over a map, looking at a map, and the map was never on the table in those negotiations except for the few minutes that he went out to the bathroom.
Very interesting. Okay.
Gershon, Stephen Stern in Washington, D.C. In the blurb for this discussion, it said the context of the disengagement in 2005 would be an issue and how it is still with us. I have one specific question, and then I would like some general reflections. The specific question is, to what degree were there international implementable protocols about the PA taking control of the Gaza borders that were there and available? How true is that? And the fact that Israel chose to have nothing to do with them, what was the dynamic of that?
Well, what happened was that Sharon refused to negotiate the disengagement with the Palestinians. The Palestinians had established an executive secretariat of 9 technical committees. This body was being led by Mohammed Dahlan at the time, and they had real professionals working on them, trying to reach out to the Israelis and coordinate with them, and the coordination was about the withdrawal, about taking over businesses, about the infrastructure, electricity and water networks and sewage, about security patrol of the borders and everything, and Israel simply refused to coordinate. Even on the issue of what to do with the assets, leaving them behind, the talk was, the Palestinian understanding was that the settlements would remain intact, that they wouldn't be demolished by Israel. In the end, the only negotiations that took place was on who was going to remove the rubble after Israel demolished all the settlements and who was going to get paid for it and who was going to pay for it. That was the talks. James Wolfensohn, the former head of the World Bank, was the appointed by the U.S. government to be a kind of emissary in charge of trying to coordinate the process of the of the disengagement, and he couldn't find any way of coordinating it. It was really problematic. After Israel left Gaza and they closed the border, in the first 100 days after the disengagement, the border between Israel and Gaza was open only 17 days. When the Palestinians took over the greenhouses of Gush Katif, which was a very profitable enterprise, being farmed, mostly the workers, 90-something, 8% of the workers were all Palestinians who continued working in the hothouses after a Palestinian holding company took them over. All the produce that was produced in the first year that they grew in those hothouses simply rotted at the border crossings because Israel didn't let them in. You might remember that Condoleezza Rice flew into Israel to try and expedite the negotiations that took place later on the issue of border management and border crossings. She even stayed in her plane at Ben Gurion Airport for an extra 5 hours and refused to leave until they signed the protocols. You can check on Google. They signed two protocols, one which was the agreement on Rafah, on movement and the agreement on movement and access, it was called, and a second agreement called the agreement on Rafah. And the agreement of Rafah included a border management supervisory task by the European Union, who created an organization called EUBAM, European Union Border Authority Management, whose task was twofold. One was to build capacity amongst the Palestinian forces of Mahmoud Abbas to run the borders, and the second capacity that they held was to be a monitoring body, because they had agreed on a fail-safe mechanism where Israel would have the right to push a red button and stop the entry of any individual person. Every person who crossed the border into Gaza, their details would appear on a security screen inside of Israel, and Israel could flash a warning, and then the Palestinians would have to hold that person for 24 hours until their case was reviewed and determined whether or not they were a danger and had to be refused entry or allowed entry. In the whole time that that mechanism was being used, Israel never pushed the button even once. But the whole mechanism broke down in June of 2007 when Hamas committed the bloody coup d'etat and threw out the Fatah forces, and the border management authority stayed out of Gaza after that time. They stayed in Israel, actually, every day. They were in Ashkelon for a couple of years in a reduced force, waiting and hoping that they would be allowed to go back. After 3 years, I think, of sitting on the beaches of Ashkelon, the EU closed down the mission entirely.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Next question, please. Once again, to ask a question, just press star 6.
This is Frank Bamberger. I have another question, if I may. On the notion that settlers in a two-state solution, that settlers could stay in what is now the territories if they agreed that Palestine was sovereign over them and would obey Palestinian laws, is that, do you see that as a possibility?
Well, I've had discussions on this issue directly with Mahmoud Abbas, and previously also with Salam Fayyad when he was prime minister. I in fact told them that if I were an Israeli negotiator sitting at the table, I would demand that the Palestinian state be open for Jews to live there. It's unthinkable in my mind that the Palestinian state would be Judenrein, in particular when we realize that the Palestinian state is being built on Judea and Samaria, which historically and from a point of view of Jewish heritage is really the place of our story. That's the land of the prophets, not the beaches of Tel Aviv, and there's an important Jewish connection to those places, even if we don't have sovereignty there. So the idea that the Palestinian state would be Judenrein would be unacceptable to me. What Abu Mazen's response was that he never objected to having Jews live in a Palestinian state. He objected to having settlers and soldiers be in the Palestinian state. Settlers, I asked him what he meant by that. He said people living in segregated communities who are armed militia with special rights above and beyond the rights of everyone else living there. But he said that if Jews wanted to live there and they were willing to accept Palestinian sovereignty and live under Palestinian law, that that would be acceptable. We talked once about the possibility of dual citizenship or of having permanent residency in Palestine and being citizens of Israel. There are all kinds of possibilities there. I think that has to be on the table. It has to be part of the negotiation. And as we as Jews should insist that that be part of the agreement. Saddam Fayyad made a very smart comment in the discussion I had with him at the time. He said that it would be good for the Palestinians to demand that the rights of the Jews in the state of Palestine would be linked one-to-one to the rights of Palestinian citizens of Israel. Whatever, however Israel treats its Palestinian citizens is the way we would treat our Jewish citizens. And I thought that was very smart because it would be perhaps the first and biggest incentive for Israel to really give equal rights to the Palestinian citizens of Israel.
Gershon, this is Alan Weisbart in Madison, Wisconsin. I wonder if we could shift subjects just a bit, and if you could enlighten us on what seems to be overwhelming Israeli sentiment against the Iran deal, what it is that is most frightening about that, how to understand what Netanyahu's motivations may be for pursuing such a divisive and unlikely to succeed attack on the American administration.
Right. Well, I would say I don't have hard polling data on this. It's more impression than hard data. But I would say that while a majority of Israelis believe that the deal is a bad deal and Obama let us down, I would think that today a majority of Israelis think that the Netanyahu campaign against President Obama and the Democratic Party is not something in Israel's interest. That seems to be appearing more and more in the mainstream media in Israel, these kind of reservations of Netanyahu should just swallow it, accept it, and begin the negotiations with the Americans on how they're going to compensate us security-wise for the bad deal that they made. The Israeli perception is that the deal is a bad deal because, you know all the arguments, because it has a time limit, it doesn't deal with folding up the entire nuclear program, there's no immediate undeclared inspections at military sites, the Iranians are going to be conducting their own inspections in military sites, a 24-day waiting period before there can be outside inspectors at military sites, and of course that 10 years or 15 years down the road they can get
right.
More enriched uranium and build bombs, and of course the loosening of the sanctions and allowing them to continue their ballistic missile program and the supporting of terrorism around the world, including their proxies like Hezbollah and others. So this is why the Israelis see the deal as a bad deal. I believe that maybe there could have been a better deal. I don't know. I think it's probably the best deal that could have been done. But I think that a bad deal is much better than no deal at all, because with no deal at all, they were 4 months away from breakout. There were no limitations on their support of proxies. They were building their ballistic missiles weapons program without any kind of reservations. Even with the international arms embargoes and sanctions, the Iranians moved forward getting very close to a bomb. We know that they've lied consistently over the past decades to the international community about their weapons program, and they would continue to lie. This is the best chance that we have of preventing them from getting a bomb. Even if the agreement doesn't succeed in doing and the Iranians cheat, it would still push them back more than a year away from the breakout when they were 4 months away from it, according to experts before the deal. So I think this is a reality that can't be challenged anymore. It's negotiated. It was accepted by the international community. It will go through the Congress, and Israel's going to have to start to deal with it in a different way. I think that Netanyahu deflected a lot of attention from other issues in the election campaign and prior to that with the threat of Iran. He's continuing to do that as presenting Iran as the existential threat to the state of Israel. He presents himself as the person who will prevent or has prevented the nuclear holocaust that would destroy the Jewish state, etc. And that's part of his technique of ruling. He spreads, embellishes, and magnifies the threats that are real. Let's admit there are real threats here, but Netanyahu exploits those threats for his own way of controlling.
Gershon, do you think that the U.S. administration, the Obama administration, could do more to assure Israel that the terrorism that's emanating from Iran will be pushed back, will be acted against by the U.S. administration? Do you think there's more assurance? And should that be before?
I think that the Americans could lead a broad international coalition that could do more against international terrorism. Of course, it's not just from Iran. And we're living in a very bizarre period of time in a very strange region where the enemies of our enemies are also the enemies of Iran. I mean, Iran is fighting against Daesh, is fighting against ISIS. And certainly the Americans want the Iranians to be involved in the fight against ISIS. At the same time, they're supporting Hezbollah, who's supporting the regime of Assad. And Assad is fighting against ISIS and fighting against Al-Qaeda. There's just so many fights going on, what's going on in Yemen and what's going on in Libya. It's difficult to understand from a day-to-day situation who's against who, who's fighting who, and how do we prevent this from boiling over into Israel's borders or into the borders of our neighbors. I mean, there's no doubt that Israel is the guarantor today for the security of the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. The security cooperation between Israel and Egypt is fundamental in ensuring that the Egyptians win and take back control over Sinai, so that the threat is not from Sinai into Israel to Eilat and along the Israeli border with Egypt. There's so many alliances here that need to be examined and understood. The Americans are playing a role in it. Look, you're over there in America. No one wants American troops back in the Middle East, and I don't think that that's the best way of dealing with it either. But certainly I think the American could play a bigger role in at an international level of trying to figure out how to do this. And one of the big things that the Americans need to do, and hopefully when Obama is freed up from dealing with Congress and the Iran deal, is to put attention back on the Palestinian issue at the Security Council together with the French and the European Union and other allies, and hopefully come out of the Security Council in November with a resolution that would be a kind of Obama parameters for Israeli-Palestinian peace that would help to save the viability of a future two-state solution and the possibility of Israel's survival as the nation-state of the Jewish people, which is also a democratic state. I think this is essential for future peace process and for the state of Israel, that the Americans play a leadership role in doing that, that the Americans don't use their veto against the rest of the world anymore on the Palestinian issue. This reassessment of American policy with regard to Israel as a result of the bad relations with Netanyahu could actually play in favor of what Israel really needs within the international framework, and that's American support for an international plan that would help us move forward toward peace.
Gershon, it's Lily again. I'd like to end on where you just said, because that should stay with us. But can you explain, other than in-your-face Netanyahu move, his appointment of Danny Danon?
The only way I could explain it is that he's far away from Jerusalem, so he's less of a problem at home. It's the absolute most idiotic appointment of anyone to such a sensitive position of diplomacy, is a man who has no diplomatic experience or abilities at all. And the only thing that he said is that when he's in the UN, he won't oppose the two-state solution anymore. I mean, I don't know how he does that, but it's really, it makes no sense at all.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I think that is all. Gershon, thank you so much for doing the call. Thanks, everyone.
All right, if I could just throw out one sentence.
Sure.
I'm coming on a speaking tour in the first half of November to the United States. I'm looking for invitations to campuses, synagogues, organizations, anywhere people who might have connections. This is part of my way that I support myself so I can do most of what I do that no one pays me for. So I'm not coming to speak pro bono. It is for pay. But if anyone has contacts or anyone would like to invite me, contact me by email, which is really simple. It's my name, GershonBaskin@gmail.com, and I'd be happy to engage in a discussion about coming anywhere in the United States or Canada during the month of November. So thank you very much, everyone.
Excellent. Thank you.
Night.